Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our seventh look at the murders of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson. Before we get into the case this week, as always, I have my normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you would like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, search for the show, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. If you'd like to make a one-time donation to the show, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast. And lastly, you can go to tinyurl.com/dcpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free episodes as well as exclusive content. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, and relax. I've got my coffee. Let's go into the crypt. We closed off last week discussing the first week of the trial and that weekend when the entire court went on a field trip to the crime scenes. The next week was followed with more testimony, with Detective Lang set to give the first part of his testimony on that Friday. Now, Lang's testimony is going to last for a full 8 days. Lang begins by walking the court through the crime scene evidence under cross-examination by Johnny Cochran. The defense really has no means to attack the evidence that is being presented. Rather, Cochran goes after Lang personally, focusing particularly on his competence and integrity. Later, Lang would say that Clark really fumbled the ball in her redirect after Cochran had questioned him, as she did not touch on a number of questions that Cochran had raised. Specifically, did Lang's decision to place a blanket over Brown's body at the crime scene compromise or contaminate the crime scene? To which Lang stated the LAPD SID's analysis of Brown's clothing showed no foreign hair or fibers, meaning that the blanket had not, in fact, contaminated the crime scene. Was the crime scene compromised after the coroner's investigator moved the blue knit cap and the white envelope containing Judith Brown's eyeglasses at the crime scene? Lang responded that there was nothing to suggest that the movement had compromised or altered the hair and fiber evidence discovered on the knit cap, which Lang pointed out the movement of was moot, as it had been documented by a photographer. When asked why Goldman and Brown's hands had not been bagged before being moved, which, for those of you who are unaware, it's standard procedure in police departments to place bags over the hands of homicide victims in order to save any evidence that might be there, such as fingernail scrapings,
Lang responded that the bodies of both victims were encased in bags before they left the crime scene. Why didn't the police conduct a tire track study on Brown's driveway? Lang responded that there were so many tracks superimposed one another that isolating any of them for testing was impossible. And why were the blood stains on Brown's back gate found on June 13th not collected until July 3rd? Lang responded that he had left the South Bundy crime scene to go downtown and interview Simpson at 12:30 on June 13th. He ordered all investigators to finish their work he had assigned and then broken down the crime scene. They're all professional and did not need someone hovering over them while they did their work. And this is a important piece here. Lang, as the lead investigator, normally would have been on the crime scene until it was completely gone over, at which point he would have done a final walkthrough to see if there was anything that had been missed, but also to see if any new evidence had presented itself. Because he was at Park Center interviewing Simpson, Lang was unable to do this final walkthrough. And because of this, and because of the other individuals on the site not seeing the blood underneath the handle on the gate, it was missed. So you can see from these questions that Cochran is really trying to put doubt in the minds of the jury, not only to Lang's level of competence, but also as to the competence of the LAPD as a whole. And I understand his reasoning, and I also understand what the jury was thinking at that point. That's a pretty big piece of evidence to miss. There are photographs of this bloodstain on the back gate, and it's not something that you can just easily walk by and not see. And the fact that it was not collected until July 3rd plays into the defense's theory that the evidence had, in fact, been planted by the LAPD. Just as the movement of the knit cap and the envelope containing Judith Brown's glasses did. Further questions raised included, why didn't Lang and other investigators wear booties over their shoes during the crime scene search? Lang stated that he had never worn booties while investigating a crime scene, although he did always wear gloves, and that there was no state or LAPD law requiring the use of such booties. Another question, why did an episode of Inside Edition show investigators trampling through the crime scene, to which Lang replied that the footage was videotaped after the crime scene had been broken down at 3:45 p.m. on June 13th, and that the same videotape showed officers earlier removing the crime scene tape from around the bungalow. Why did Lang and Van Adder only find two cuts on Simpson's left hand when a doctor had discovered no fewer than 7 injuries on June 14th? Lang responded that he and Van Adder had examined Simpson's hands on June 13th, and he insisted that none of the other cuts found by this doctor were present when they examined Simpson's hands. Cochran then asked about the quote-unquote wad of money, which totaled nearly $8,000 in cash and checks, that Simpson had stated was stolen by the LAPD on the June 13th search. It should be noted that Lang stated he knew nothing about the money, and that Simpson, prior to the cross-examination of Lang, had informed his defense team that he had simply misplaced it and had, in fact, found the money. Although the defense team, knowing this, went forward with this line of questioning in an effort to further smear Lang and the LAPD. Why didn't the coroner save the victim's stomach contents, which could have established a more precise estimate of time of death? The response was that crime labs do not normally save the contents of a victim's stomach unless it plays a part in the crime. Cochran also asked why the LAPD had not used a rape kit on Brown, to which Lang responded that there was no evidence that a sexual assault had taken place. When asked why the LAPD determined only one perpetrator was responsible, Lang responded that there was only one set of bloody shoe prints leading from the crime scene. The commonality, as well as the severity, amount, and dimensions of the wounds, that both victims had been hit from behind in the head, that the blood found on the bottom of Goldman's boots was a mixture of both victims' blood, meaning that it was cast-off blood from the same night. And lastly, that the blood evidence that had been discovered linked only three individuals to the crime scene: Nicole Brown Simpson, Ron Goldman, and Orenthal James Simpson. When asked why the LAPD had not investigated whether the crimes had been drug-related, Lang responded that over 518 leads had come in the case, 50 of which had concerned suspects other than Simpson. He also stated that any lead that came in was checked out as thoroughly as was possible. He also stated that no evidence had been presented showing that drug dealers or drug addicts had been involved in the murders. We are doubling back just a little bit to discuss a couple of things that happened during the beginning part of this trial. I apologize for this. This is not normally how I do things. However, this episode has been recorded over multiple days because there are things going on in the real world that have had to be taken care of. One key thing that happened is on January 27th of 1995, O.J. Simpson released his book, I Want to Tell You My Response to Your Letters, Your Messages, and Your Questions. And it's basically part of the defense strategy, O.J. telling everyone that he's not guilty. The defense is trying to get ahead of everything with the release of this book because O.J. is being tried in the court of public opinion just as much as he is being tried in the legal court. One of the reasons that this was done was to try and salvage Simpson's reputation because the defense believed that they were going to win this case, obviously, and OJ still had to make a living and pay his legal bills when all of this was done. There was a mistaken belief then, as there is now among members of the defense team, that O.J. Simpson was one of the most beloved individuals within the entertainment industry. The reality is, most people were aware of him, but he was not a superstar such as a Warren Beatty. On February 3rd, Denise Brown took the stand and recounted the horrific abuse that her sister had endured at the hands of O.J. Simpson. Back to the story at hand, Lang is still on the stand, and Johnny Cochran tries again to paint Detective Lang in the most unfavorable light possible, pointing out that he lives in Simi Valley. There is some significance to this, as the jury was largely black. But also, Simi Valley was where the trial of the officers in the Rodney King beating took place. If you remember that, the Rodney King trial led to the riots in Los Angeles. The reason the defense is bringing this up is they're trying to paint the police force as racist. During all of this, it's learned that Christopher Darden had contacted the Geraldo Rivera show and spoken live on the air, complaining that the officers who are testifying are not being aggressive enough on the stand, something that infuriates the officers. And this goes into the circus-like atmosphere that has arisen around this case. The members of the prosecution team seem almost to care more about their rising celebrity than they do about actually winning this case. Now, on March 9th, Detective Mark Furman goes on the stand, and this is really going to be one of the most contentious points of the entire trial. After being questioned by the prosecution team, F. Lee Bailey goes on the attack, painting Mark Furman as a racist, while leading him in questions to try and get Furman to admit that he had planted evidence at the North Rockingham estate because he was either in a relationship with Nicole Simpson, wanted to be, or simply because he is a racist. Things take a sharp turn on March 15th when Bailey starts asking Furman if he had ever used the N-word to describe African Americans, or had used the term in the last 10 years, which Furman denies. Because of this testimony, members of the defense team tell the media that police are routinely trained to lie on the witness stand. In his book, Alan Dershowitz asserts, quote, "We charged a handful of Los Angeles police officers with conspiring to lie about why they went to Simpson's house and entered his property without a warrant. Having established its likelihood, we then raised questions about the actions of an even smaller number of bad cops, Van Adder and Furman, who could easily have sprinkled Simpson's blood, which Van Adder had been carrying around for 3 hours, on the socks, the glove, and the back gate. That was the conspiracy." In point of fact, as we discussed when covering the crimes and the day after, Van Adder did not have Simpson's blood until after 2 p.m. when Simpson willingly allowed his blood to be drawn, as that's the only vial of blood that the officers had access to. So the idea that the officers were in fact carrying this blood around with them prior to interviewing O.J. Simpson is in fact a fallacy. The fact that the prosecution did not really challenge any of these assertions made by the defense team speaks greatly to how woefully inept the prosecution was and how star-swept they were by all of the things going on around this case. And this happens continuously throughout the trial as Cochran paints Van Adder with the brush as a crooked and bad cop, and Lang as an officer who had not done anything to stop his partner's malicious, citing the supposed blue wall of silence, wherein another officer will never testify or speak ill of another officer when there are going to be consequences. Cochran is quoted as saying at one point in the trial, quote, "Officers fixed immediately on O.J. Simpson as their suspect and simply ignored anything that might have deflected them in another, perhaps more arduous direction. Having rushed to that judgment, Van Adder decided to improve the case to make sure that came out the way he thought they should. Lang, his partner, well-schooled in the department's traditional code of silence, simply looked away, as he doubtless had many times before." On March 16th, Van Adder takes the stand the first of 4 days, during which he recounts everything that happened at both the crime scene at South Bundy as well as at the crime scene at North Rockingham. On cross-examination, Robert Shapiro attacks Van Adder over his handling of the blood evidence, also going after him for not collecting the carton of Ben & Jerry's at the crime scene. When asked when Simpson became a suspect in the case, Van Adder replies, quote, "He became a suspect as soon as I saw the glove at the side of the house. After coming out into the driveway and finding the blood trail, he became a very strong suspect." On March 21st, Cato Kaelin takes the stand, basically recounting the events of June 12th, his interactions with Simpson. On March 29th, the Sky Cap who handled Simpson's belongings at LAX on the 12th states that he saw Simpson next to a large trash can near the Sky Cap stand. And the prosecution is questioning this individual in an effort to try and show what may have happened to the bloody clothing Simpson had worn, as well as the murder weapon. If you'll remember, Simpson had a half-moon-shaped bag with him when he left the house at North Rockingham that has never been seen since. Following this testimony, officers learned that another witness had seen Simpson at LAX and had actually seen him removing his arm from inside this trash can, and that on top of this trash can was a small travel bag which was shaped like a half moon. The detectives have this witness meet them at LAX, where he walks them through where he was and everything that he had witnessed. After this, the officers contact Marcia Clark, wanting to her to have the opportunity to question this witness. After interviewing the man, Clark declines to use him. Again, in my opinion, another major misstep by the prosecution. After all of this and the testimony of Robert Park, the limousine driver, members of the SID Crime Lab take the stand discussing the technical aspects of this case. Now, unfortunately, Dennis Fung had made a number of small mistakes while collecting evidence at the crime scene, and the defense jumps all over this, basically painting it out to be that if he made these small mistakes, it's very probable that he made much larger intentional mistakes. One of the major takeaway from Fung's testimony is that proper protocols were not completely followed at the crime scenes. This is playing right into the defense's assertion that Simpson was in fact focused upon from the start. There may have been evidence planting, and that not everything that the prosecution is presenting is, in fact, as it seems. And this is a dangerous place for the prosecution to be. One of the things that they were able to elicit from Fung is the fact that Detective Lang, while back at the South Bundy crime scene after being at North Rockingham, where Fung had collected all of the evidence that the officers had found, had demanded to see the glove that Fung had discovered, as he wanted to compare the two gloves. Basically, they tried to paint a picture that Lang had asked Fung to retrieve the glove from inside of his truck and bring it onto the South Bundy crime scene. They went so far as to show video of Fung carrying a paper bag onto the crime scene. This is important as it has already been established that the SID investigators routinely used brown paper bags to remove evidence from crime scenes. In another dramatic turn of events, after 9 days of questioning by the defense team, Fung actually shakes the hand of one of the attorneys after he is released from the witness stand. On May 10th, the prosecution begins to present the actual DNA case. They point out that four different laboratories had, in fact, tested the blood, and they found that blood consistent with Brown and Goldman was discovered in Simpson's Bronco, on the right-hand glove found at North Rockingham,
and that blood consistent with Brown's had been found on the socks in O.J. Simpson's bedroom. They also point out that blood droplets found at the South Bundy crime scene were consistent with that of O.J. Simpson, stating that there was a 1 in 170 million chance that the blood found at Nicole Brown Simpson's house came from O.J. Simpson. To give you an idea of the media circus that is going on now, the area around the courthouse is filled with vendors who are selling memorabilia with Simpson's face on it, members of the prosecution, as well as detectives, and various pithy sayings. It's not the type of thing that was seen in other trials prior to this, and to the best of my knowledge, really doesn't happen at trials now. So you can see the carnival-like atmosphere that is going on, not only in Los Angeles, but all across the nation, as this is the most watched thing, really, in television history, if you take it as a whole. The prosecution also learns during this period of time that members of the defense team are investigating the backgrounds of members of the jury, one of whom had been released from the jury after it was discovered that she was allegedly planning to write a book about the case after the conclusion of the trial. Two more jurors are released on June 5th, numbers 9 and 10, for various reasons. After being dismissed, one of the jurors tells the media that the police cannot violate a man's rights and go over the wall, basically saying whether Simpson did it or not, this individual was more likely than not going to vote to acquit Simpson. This juror further states, just because they're blood, it doesn't mean much. A lot of people have the same kind of blood, which, as we know now, and was fairly well known back then by law enforcement, is not the case and is nowhere close to being the truth. I'm not saying that DNA evidence is infallible. In fact, yearly number of cases are overturned because of faulty DNA evidence. But for this individual to have that mindset after things have been explained to him very tediously shows you where this juror's head was at regarding O.J. Simpson. After the Los Angeles County coroner testifies about the wounds he observed on both of the bodies as well as the contents of the bodies and states that one person could have committed these murders, the prosecution calls in witnesses to attest to the fact that O.J. Simpson did in fact own a pair of gloves similar to the ones that were found at both crime scenes. In one of the most famous scenes of the trial, Christopher Darden has O.J. Simpson try the gloves that were discovered on. Simpson makes a great show of trying to get his hands inside of the gloves, declaring that they are too tight. Now, some have asserted that Simpson had not taken his arthritis medication leading up to this point in the trial. My take on it is actually a little bit different. While it could be true that Simpson had not tried or had not taken his medication, it could also be true that because of the fact that the gloves were so soaked in blood, they may in fact have shrunk as the gloves heated up with heat, the blood dried. This does happen with certain types of gloves and other fabrics. When they are wet, they expand, and as they dry, they contract. This could in fact have been the case with Simpson trying on the gloves. Another factor in the gloves not fitting is that Simpson wore latex gloves on his hand before putting the gloves on. This might not seem like that big of a deal, as latex gloves are very thin. With these gloves, because they were such an exact fit, even something as
thin and as insignificant as the latex gloves is going to make the gloves that are placed on the hand appear to be much tighter and smaller than they actually are. Something noted during this entire ordeal is that two of the jurors are actually laughing as Simpson struggles to put the gloves on his hands. Richard Rubin, who worked for the manufacturer of the glove company, states during testimony that the gloves had actually shrunken one full size due to the amount of blood that was on them, and that another pair of gloves, the exact same make, model, and size, do in fact fit Simpson. The image of Simpson struggling to put on the actual gloves used is burned into the jury's mind. The prosecution suffers further setbacks when one of their witnesses, Nicole Brown Simpson's neighbor, who had heard the dogs wailing, states that she heard a man's voice yelling, "Hey, hey, hey," around 10:35 to 10:40 p.m., which is about a half an hour, give or take, after the prosecution contended the murders took place at 10:15. Essentially poking a massive hole in the prosecution's case, as they were unwilling to concede the fact that the time of the murders may in fact have been later, and that Simpson fleeing the scene and then being seen running over the front yard of his house may have happened just around this time. Other witnesses testify that they had passed by the house between 10:15 and 10:25 and had seen or heard nothing. Again, major holes are being blown in the prosecution's case. Detectives also learn on June 28th that the prosecution is not going to be presenting a good amount of evidence that the detectives believe is the best evidence that they have. Some of these items include the taped interview with Nicole Brown in October of 1993, where Brown says that Simpson is going to kill her. If you'll recall, this was in fact the night of the infamous 911 call. The testimony from the limousine driver in Connecticut, who stated that he had seen Simpson with knives from the Swiss Army knife factory and had heard Simpson about fantasizing about killing somebody with a knife. Dominique Brown identifying the shoes that Simpson is alleged to have worn on the night of the murders, which she contends she saw him wearing in 1994. The discovered removed light bulb inside Simpson's Bronco. A witness who heard the murders occurring between 10:36 and 10:40. The testimony of the individual who had seen Simpson removing his arm from the trash can at LAX. A Hertz employee in Chicago who noticed how empty Simpson's travel bags were. The June 13th interview with O.J. Simpson conducted by Lange and Van Atter, where Simpson repeatedly contradicts himself. The suicide note found on June 16th. From the Kardashian home, the events leading up to Simpson's arrest on the 17th, including the Bronco chase, the tape-recorded conversation between Detective Lange and Simpson while Simpson was inside of the Bronco with a gun to his head, the possessions found with Simpson and Al Cowlings after Simpson's arrest, as well as the keys found inside of Simpson's travel bag that fit into the front gate and front door of Nicole Brown's house. Now, the reason given for this is because the prosecution believed that anything that the LAPD had collected was now tainted by the tactics of the defense team, and I'm going to contend that
this is, again, the ineptitude of the prosecution for a case this massive. All of this evidence, despite the fact that the defense team had been painting the LAPD as racists hellbent on convicting a single person, should have been presented, and individuals within the prosecution's office who were over Clark and Darden, knowing the case and knowing the evidence that they had, should have stepped in and either demanded that they do it or requested that new prosecutors be assigned to the case due to ineptitude on the part of those representing the state. It's an unheard of maneuver, but it is possible. On July 6th, the prosecution, after presenting hair and fiber evidence found on the knit cap and right-hand glove that are considered consistent with the fibers inside O.J. Simpson's Bronco, rests its case. One thing I do need to point out is that fiber evidence is open to interpretation. If you are familiar with the series I did on the Atlanta child murders, Wayne Williams's conviction largely rests on the fiber evidence, specifically fibers found on victims' bodies that were later discovered to be in a rug at the Williams's home. And the reason why fiber evidence is tricky is because while an individual who is a quote-unquote expert may ascertain that fibers came from a specific area, other than the statements from that witness, there really is no way to absolutely 100% factually prove that is the case. The defense begins its case 4 days after the prosecution rests, presenting numerous witnesses while contending that Simpson was framed by the LAPD and that this was done because of racist cops. On August 10th, the defense turns over tapes that Detective Mark Furman had made during the investigation of the crimes with screenwriter Laura Hart McKinney. And these tapes are going to be devastating for the prosecution because there are 13 hours of conversation. Judge Ito states in open court on the 15th that, quote, just when you thought we couldn't have anything crazier happen, as he discusses the evidence on the tapes wherein Furman describes Ito's wife as a quote-unquote fat slob who sucked her way to the top. This has an obvious effect on Judge Ito, who weeps openly in court, stating that he loves his wife. Marcia Clark then raises questions as to whether or not Ito being attacked in the tapes in this fashion is not a conflict of interest. Ito considers recusing himself from the trial. These tapes are rife with Furman using racial slurs and other various terms to describe everyone who is not white. Furman's lawyer, attempting to put the fire out, claims that, quote, these comments were made as part of a story conference for a fictional screenplay. They're not Mark speaking as himself. During one part of the tapes, Furman says, quote, Wilshire Division is all N-words. All N-words. All N-words. N-words training officers. Remember, Furman had stated on the stand that he had not used that particular term in the last 10 years. Also on these tapes, Furman states, quote, I am the key witness in the biggest case of the century, and if I go down, they lose the case. The glove is everything. Without the glove, bye-bye. And as these tapes are played in open court, Johnny Cochran stands up and exclaims, "This is a blockbuster. This is a bombshell. This is perhaps the biggest thing that's happened in any case in the country in this decade, and they know it. They've got to face up to it." While Ito is considering recusing himself and whether or not the tape should actually be played for the jury, the defense calls an individual who used to work for the SIDS team, who basically defecates all over the work done on this case. On August 29th, screenwriter Laura McKinney testifies in open court. Something else that is going to come back to haunt the defense because of Furman's words is the fact that the defense had requested to question Lang again, and they simply asked him whether or not Furman had been at the autopsy, to which Lang states he had not. On August 31st, Judge Ito allows two excerpts to be played from the tapes, which Cochran states is proof of the conspiracy to cover up the police's wrongdoings in this case. Quote, "The cover-up continues. This inexplicable, indefensible ruling lends credence to all those who say the criminal justice system is corrupt." On September 5th, the jury hears the two excerpts. Talking about female police officers, Furman states, "They don't do anything. They don't go out there and initiate a contact with some 6'5" that's been in prison for 7 years pumping weights." After this, the defense presents a slew of witnesses who have heard Furman use the N-word. An LAPD photographer is called to the stand and claims that he had, in fact, photographed Furman pointing to the glove found at the South Bundy crime scene at 4 p.m. when neither Lang nor Van Adder were at the crime scenes. It should be pointed out that according to official logs, this picture was taken at 7 a.m. on the morning of the 13th, and that this photographer, who at the time was on medical leave, was under heavy medication, and in fact, this medication had caused him to make misstatements during earlier trial testimony. September 6th, Furman is now called back to the stand without the jury present and is asked whether or not he wishes to continue to assert that his earlier testimony was complete and factual. Furman replies that he is taking the Fifth Amendment. He is asked, has he ever falsified a police report? Furman then states he takes the Fifth Amendment. He is then asked whether he plans to take the Fifth Amendment to all questions presented to him, which Furman responds with a resounding yes. After asserting they have no more questions, the defense asks one more, asking whether or not Furman had planted or had concocted any evidence in this trial. Furman again pleads the Fifth. While this does not have any sort of bearing on the physical trial because the jury is not present, it paints a devastating picture for the television viewers watching at home. After playing the tapes in the court, Cochran announces that Simpson will not be taking the stand. Obviously, this was never going to happen, as that would open Simpson up to cross-examination by the prosecution. The defense is also able to get Ito to tell the jury that Furman had taken the Fifth when asked questions by the defense team. The prosecution objects to this, and it is sent to the California Court of Appeals. The prosecution decides that they're not going to rest their case until they hear back on this. So the prosecution then presents rebuttal witnesses to the ones that the defense has given. On September 18th,
the Court of Appeals rejects the defense's motion concerning Furman's pleading of the Fifth, and the prosecution officially rests its case. The defense then does a rebuttal of the prosecution and basically attacks the LAPD as a racist organization. After both sides have rested their cases, the court has a day where Simpson is set to waive his right to testimony, and Ito grants Simpson the opportunity to say something in open court without the jury present. Simpson states, "I did not, could not, and would not have committed this crime." On September 26th, the prosecution gives its closing argument, wherein it basically goes over everything that they have presented in court. On September 27th, Johnny Cochran gives his statement, basically asking the jury to nullify everything that has been presented by the prosecution, stating at one point, "One of the things that has made this country so great is people's willingness to stand up and say this is wrong. I'm not going to be a part of it. I'm not going to be a part of the cover-up. That is what I'm asking you to do." Another famous quip from this trial comes from Cochran's closing arguments. Many people attribute this to Simpson's gloves, when in fact it concerns the knit cap found at the South Bundy crime scene. Cochran states, "It's no disguise. It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit." After this, Cochran then goes on to attack Philip Van Adder pretty viciously. After his closing argument has concluded, Judge Ito gives the jury their instructions, informing them that they are still sequestered and may not discuss the case with anyone at all, and that they are in fact not to begin their deliberations until Monday, October 2nd. At 9:16 a.m. on Monday, October 2nd, the jury begins their deliberations on O.J. Simpson's murder trial, and at 2:28 p.m. that same day, they notify the judge that they have reached a verdict. Should be noted that during their brief deliberations, the jury had only requested to see one piece of evidence, and that was a transcript of the testimony of the limousine driver on the night of June 12th. At roughly 3 p.m., Ito informs the court that the jury will return the following morning at 10 a.m. to deliver their verdict. At this point, I am going to play audio of that verdict.
Mr. Simpson, would you please stand and face the jury? Mrs. Robertson.
Superior Court of California, County of Los Angeles, in the matter of the people of the state of California versus Orenthal James Simpson, case number BA-097-211. We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony upon Nicole Brown Simpson, a human being, as charged in count one of the information. Superior Court of the State of California, County of Los Angeles, in the matter of the people of the State of California versus Orenthal James Simpson, we, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony upon Ronald Lyle Goldman, a human being, as charged in count two of the information. We, the jury, in the above entitled action, further find the special circumstance that the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, has in this case been convicted of at least one crime of murder of the first degree and one or more crimes of murder of the first or second degree to be not true. Signed this second day of October 1995, juror 230. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is this your verdict? So say you won, so say you all.
Yes. All right, counsel, Mr. Simpson, would you be seated, please? Just have it quiet in the courtroom, please. All right, Mrs. Robertson, would you please poll the jurors?
Juror number one, as to count one, is this your verdict?
Yes.
Juror number two, as to count one, is this your verdict? Juror number three, as to count one, is this your verdict? Juror number four, as to count one, is this your verdict?
Yes.
Juror number five, as to count one, is this your verdict?
Yes.
Juror number six, as to count one, is this your verdict?
Yes.
Juror number seven, as to count one, is this your verdict?
Yes.
Juror number eight, as to count one, is this your verdict?
Yes.
Juror number nine, as to count one, is this your verdict?
Yes.
Juror number 10, as to count one, is this your verdict? Juror number 11, as to count one, is this your verdict? Juror number 12, as to count one, is this your verdict?
As you heard there, Simpson was found not guilty by a jury of his peers.
You may be thinking that, okay, so that's the end of it. This
series is over. It is not. We have some alternative theories that we're going to look at in the next episode or two, as well as the civil case that was brought against O.J. Simpson by the Brown and Goldman's families. However, we are going to end it at this point with Simpson having been found not guilty of the crimes that he was accused of. I hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Death Cast, and I look forward to seeing you back here next week. Until then, the Death Cast is a co-production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasts. Stay morbid!